Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I am excited to have with me today Mike Hofkamp again, who I'll introduce and talk to in a second. First, I wanted to say that since I have a moment here up front, if you are interested in a really fascinating book that does delve actually into both medicine and science in a variety of ways, I am currently reading Michael Lewis's book called The Undoing Project. It is the story of the friendship and the work of Amos Tversky and Daniel Kahneman. They both very famous psychologists, and they did a lot of the foundational work on heuristics and the way that the human mind makes mistakes and why. It is also covered in many ways in Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow, which is another fantastic book that I highly recommend, but really interesting, does a lot of dealing with the way that people make shortcuts in their brain so that they can deal with a lot of information quickly, but those shortcuts can cause us to make mistakes. We tend to estimate things incorrectly. We tend to get anchored by a prior number. This is, for example, why if you are initially told that a house is worth $1 million, you are more likely to pay more for it than if you were initially told it was worth $700,000, because you're anchored at that initial level. And even if you go in thinking about a certain amount you're going to pay for it, you're going to be affected by that anchoring dynamic. They also did the work that's foundational in why we now know, and I was even taught in medical school, that if you tell a patient that a certain procedure or a certain surgery, if they have it, will have a 10% chance of death, they're much less likely to decide to do it than if you tell them it has a 90% chance of survival. And so even though that's the exact same thing, the way you phrase that will greatly affect the way people respond and the choices they make. And so there's all of these really interesting things. I can't recommend the book more. Michael Lewis, of course, is a fantastic writer and has written other books like Moneyball that have become very popular. I think everything he's written has been really, really interesting. So check it out, The Undoing Project by Michael Lewis, as well as Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. All right, folks, let's get on with the main show. I'm thrilled to have back with me today Dr. Mike Hofkamp, who is, as you probably remember, Clinical Associate Professor at Texas A&M University Health Sciences Center College of Medicine and the Director of Obstetric Anesthesia at Scott & White Medical Center Temple. And we had an overview last time of some maternal physiology, and now today we're going to get into a little more of a sub-area of OB anesthesia, and we're going to talk about obstetric pharmacology and fetal assessment. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Jed.
So the way I think we can approach this, we'll spend a bunch of time on pharmacology, and then we'll also look at some issues of fetal assessment. So what do you think? Why don't we start with pharmacology and go from there?
Okay. So the first thing I'd like to talk about is our inhalational agents that we use in the operating room. Now, obviously, the inhalational agents are going to be rapidly transferred across the placenta of the fetus, and inhalational agents have been associated with lower Apgar scores, particularly when you have longer induction to delivery times. So the key point to remember for inhalational agents is that you want to minimize them when you're having to perform a C-section or general anesthesia, and you don't want to start your C-section until the obstetricians are scrubbed with knives in hands ready to cut.
Okay. Now, what about the effect of inhalational agents on the uterine tone?
Okay, well, inhalational agents on the uterine tone will relax the uterus, and sometimes this is advantageous when you have a situation where the uterus needs to be relaxed, like in uterine inversion, or if you really need to get a fetus out. But this is obviously problematic when you're trying to get the uterus to contract after the baby's out. I won't steal the thunder from a later lecture of our C-section anesthesia, but in general, inhalational agents will relax the uterus.
Okay. How about other anesthetic drugs?
So nitrous oxide is the other drug we'll use during general anesthesia, and sometimes just for supplemental analgesia during a C-section. And this can cause diffusion hypoxia in the infant. So any neonate that is exposed to nitrous oxide prior to delivery should have supplemental oxygen immediately after delivery.
Okay. So can you tell me how that happens? So the nitrous oxide diffuses into the, obviously, the blood that gets to the fetus, and then what happens that causes that hypoxemia?
Well, just like it sounds, the nitrous oxide goes across the placenta, goes into the fetus. The fetus will have some nitrous oxide in its bloodstream, in its stores, and when it's delivered, it will excrete that nitrous oxide through their lungs. They'll breathe it out, and that crowds out the oxygen in the alveoli, and it could potentially cause hypoxemia.
Got it. All right. So we've talked about inhalational agents, including nitrous. What about other anesthetic drugs that we need to think about?
So benzodiazepines are another drug to think about. Typically, we don't really give benzodiazepines around the time of delivery, but they can be given in very select circumstances. Things to remember that drugs like diazepam is lipophilic and crosses the placenta rapidly. Lorazepam is less lipophilic. And in fact, midazolam, the drug that we're most likely to use in the operating room, is more polarized and crosses the placenta less. So if you make the judgment call that you want to give your laboring patient or your patient in the operating room a benzodiazepine, midazolam, due to its polarity, is probably the best choice.
Okay, that's good to know. Now, we should probably point out, as you mentioned earlier, we're making a distinction here between actual C-section anesthesia, which we'll do a separate talk on, and
right.
What we're talking about now is obstetric pharmacology. So this could be, for example, a woman who's pregnant coming to the operating room for an appendectomy. It doesn't mean we're not dealing specifically with a pregnant woman having a C-section.
That's correct. Thank you for making that point.
All right, great. So we talked about benzos. Anything else? How about propofol?
Let's see here. So let's talk about opioids.
Okay, let's start with opioids.
So opioids, piperidine is associated with neonatal central nervous system and respiratory depression. We don't usually give piperidine as a pure analgesic. We usually give it for shivering. But it's useful to remember that if you're going to give piperidine to the pregnant patient, it's going to be associated with these bad things. Morphine and fentanyl rapidly cross the placenta. Remifentanyl, because of its ester group, is rapidly metabolized, and it is an ideal drug to give an induction for a C-section. And there are mixed opioid agonist antagonists like butorphanol and nalbuphine that are given for laboring patients. So
remifentanyl sounds like very safe, and that makes sense because of the short half-life. If you do give a longer-acting narcotic, anything from fentanyl or even more longer-acting, Dilaudid or morphine, the downside would be potentially respiratory depression in the neonate if a baby were actually going to be born, right? Are there downsides in a woman who's, let's say, 30 weeks pregnant having an appendectomy?
I wouldn't think so. I think that all these bad effects from morphine and other drugs are only going to be realized if the fetus is delivered with those drugs on board.
Okay, great. So they do cross to the fetus, but temporary effects that aren't long-lasting.
Correct.
Okay.
All right, I'm sorry. I'll get back to your propofol question. So,
sure.
So propofol, obviously, is lipophilic. It can cross the placenta. Interestingly enough, a historical tidbit is Apgar scores are higher in thiopental inductions compared to propofol inductions. That's kind of a moot point now that thiopental isn't commercially available. But for C-section anesthetics, obviously propofol is going to cross placenta. It's going to have some effect on the fetus. The volatile is probably going to have just as much effect. For as far as non-C-section anesthetics, just like the opioids we talked about, the effects of propofol are going to be short-lived and not realized unless the fetus is delivered with the propofol in its bloodstream.
Great. Now, how about very early in pregnancy, Mike, first trimester, for example? Mm-hmm. Is there worry at all about any teratogenic effects of any of these, propofol, benzos? Would you avoid them in a woman having a non-related surgery but who happened to be pregnant?
So with midazolam, that is a theoretical risk of teratogenicity. So we do avoid midazolam in the first and second trimesters, and we really try to avoid it throughout. But it's reasonable to give midazolam to a woman who is, I think, past the stage of organogenesis if it's made in a thoughtful way.
Okay. And then the other thing that comes to mind is that isn't an anesthetic drug per se, but that we might give would be, what about painkillers like NSAIDs?
Well, with NSAIDs, those, to my knowledge, don't have any teratogenic effects, but they do have some implications for patients towards term delivery who have heart problems, particularly with patients who need a patent ductus arteriosus to maintain oxygenation with a congenital heart lesion. So I would probably avoid NSAIDs unless I really had good evidence that the fetus's circulation was normal.
All right, great. And as far as I know, no issues with Tylenol, is that right?
No issues at all with Tylenol, not for the fetus at least.
Okay. I know there is some data out there, though I don't think it's very definitive at all, about the potential connection of Tylenol use in pregnant women and later development of asthma in children, but I certainly don't think it's been established to the point where anybody's recommending against using Tylenol while pregnant.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's a theoretical concern, but in my practice, I think that Tylenol is a very reasonable drug that we give all the time to pregnant people.
Great. Anything else in the anesthetic drug category, anything that we should be thinking about?
Well, local anesthetics, we can talk about that just for a moment.
Sure.
So, obviously, pregnant patients are going to be more sensitive to the effects of local anesthetics, like we talked about before in the internal physiology lecture. One of the interesting things about pregnancy is that it can lead to decreased alpha-1 acid glycoprotein levels, which results in a higher concentration of free lidocaine. So I give a bolus of lidocaine to a non-pregnant patient. They have normal alpha-1 acid glycoprotein levels. A bunch of that lidocaine gets sucked up, if you will, by that protein. And pregnant people, it's less so. So you're going to have each dose of lidocaine you get is going to be more potent.
Okay, it's good to know. So do you down-regulate or do you decrease the amount of lidocaine you give just pre-induction to a woman who's pregnant?
It's not necessarily. I'll dose it still 1 milligram per kilogram, and I haven't had any real problems. As far as dosing up an epidural with lidocaine, the epidural space is such a nebulous space that I don't think that this alpha-1 glycoprotein deal has anything to do with how that's going to turn out. But it is kind of a tidbit that the board might test you on.
Okay, good to know. All right. Anything else before we move on?
No, I think we can move on to the next topic, oxytoxic drugs.
Yeah, so tell me, what does that mean? What's an oxytoxic drug?
Oxytoxic drug is a drug that can cause the uterus to contract. That's how we think of it in obstetric anesthesia. It's produced by the hypothalamus, and it can also be given exogenously as a drug. And we use it in obstetrics to induce labor and to make the uterus contract after delivery to stop blood loss.
And this is Pitocin, is that right?
Correct. The Pitocin is the trade name.
Okay.
But the generic name is oxytocin.
Great.
And the interesting thing about oxytocin is that on the labor and delivery unit, it's dosed by protocol. So the obstetric staff will write an order for an oxytocin infusion, and the nurses will follow a standardized protocol. And so they're not calling the obstetric staff or residents every single 5 minutes to figure out whether they need to go up or down. One of the interesting things on the labor and delivery unit in particular is that if you give too much oxytocin, you can get uterine hyperstimulation. Mm-hmm. This is where the uterus can contract so forcefully and frequently that fetal blood flow is interrupted. And so when you have uterine hyperstimulation, you really have to, number one, stop the oxytocin infusion, and two, possibly even consider giving a drug like terbutaline to stop the contractions.
And terbutaline is a beta agonist, is that right?
Terbutaline is a beta agonist. And it can also, here's the one thing you should probably remember about terbutaline if you're going to be taking the board exam. It can cause pulmonary edema. That seems to be one of the favorite things they ask about terbutaline.
Yep.
So terbutaline equals pulmonary edema.
All right.
It can also cause hyperglycemia and hypokalemia, as it is a beta agonist.
Okay. So those are key side effects to know. It's a uterine relaxant, as you said. And so if you get into hyperstimulation from oxytocin, it's essentially an antidote for that.
Yes. And let me talk about methyl ergonovine. So this is a drug that causes the uterus to contract a lot. And this drug is reserved for the use of pretty significant postpartum hemorrhage. And it should never be given IV because that could cause some really, really bad effects. It's always given IM. And it is contraindicated in preeclampsia. So if someone has gestational hypertension or preeclampsia, methyl ergonovine has been associated with intracerebral hemorrhage. So you want to avoid methyl ergonovine in patients who have those conditions.
And this is the medication that's often referred to as Methergen?
Correct. That's the, yes.
Okay. So as you said, used to control postpartum hemorrhage in the sense that it's going to cause contraction of the uterus and therefore squeezing down on those blood vessels, but should be given IM only and has the side effect of hypertension, which you wouldn't want in someone with preeclampsia.
That is correct. So another drug that we can use to cause the uterus to contract are prostaglandins. And the trade name for the drug that we use in the operating room is Hemabate. Now, this is a good drug for someone who has preeclampsia, but it's a bad drug for someone who's got asthma because it can cause bronchoconstriction. So someone has asthma, do not give them Hemabate.
Now, I remember that sometimes they ask a question where the answer is Hemabate, but they don't tell you the name Hemabate. They give you the, and you're going to have to remind me, but I think it's something like 5-methyl something or other, right?
That's prostaglandin F2 alpha, I believe.
Prostaglandin F2 alpha. Okay, not 5-methyl. I was wrong there, but it was an F2 alpha was what I was thinking of. So prostaglandin F2 alpha, they may have that as an answer choice. So you have to recognize that Hemabate is prostaglandin F2 alpha is known as Hemabate.
Yeah.
All right. So those are two drugs often present in the operating room for a C-section to control postpartum hemorrhage, or could be for after a regular delivery that you would have available. You mentioned the important side effects, the contraindications, Methergen contraindicated for preeclampsia, Hemabate contraindicated in asthmatics.
Yes.
All right. Are there other tocolytic drugs that we should talk about?
So let's talk about the magnesium sulfate.
Okay.
So that can be used as a tocolytic. It's usually used as a preeclamptic drug to prevent seizures, but it can be used as a tocolytic. One of the things to remember about magnesium sulfate is it can potentiate the effects of non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers.
Yep.
And so if you have a patient who is on MAG and you give them a non-depolarizer such as rocuronium or vecuronium, you can expect that they are going to be exquisitely sensitive to that, and it's going to be harder to reverse neuromuscular blockade.
All right, that's important. That's asked a lot.
Another interesting thing about magnesium sulfate that's asked a lot is that it reduces the minimum alveolar concentration.
Right. So it decreases MAC, increases the action of non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers. The other thing that's asked about MAG a fair amount are the levels of MAG at which you start to see side effects.
Yes. And so you got to monitor the patients for signs of toxicity. And so you'll see the obstetricians out with their reflex hammers, and that's one of the first things to go is the deep tendon reflexes. Now later on, you're going to see respiratory depression very late. You're going to see altered mental status very late. And you really definitely want to monitor for those things. And going to the lab is going to take too long. You really want to be able to identify these things at the bedside.
Right. Now, so again, you're right. The levels they may ask you about, and I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you start to get a depression of deep tendon reflexes in the 5 to 8 category, and then respiratory depression in the kind of 10 to 15 category, cardiac depression in the 15 to 20. Is that right?
Yeah, that's roughly correct. And the therapeutic range for magnesium sulfate is around 4 to 8 milligrams per deciliter. So if you're getting loss of deep tendon reflexes, that's actually a reassuring sign that you've got enough mag on board. But mm-hmm. if you're starting to get the other bad things, then that's a sign that you've gone a little bit too far.
Okay. So magnesium, both for tocolysis, which I guess we should just define as trying to stop contractions. So this might be someone in preterm labor. Do you ever use magnesium to treat uterine hyperstimulation from oxytocin?
Typically not. Typically we'll use tributyline.
Okay.
Tributyline is a little bit quicker and has a different mechanism of action that's more amenable to stopping the contractions.
All right. So the most common use of magnesium in a pregnant woman would be treating someone who is preeclamptic. And then it's also used, as you said, for tocolysis. And I believe, and I'm stretching here, but that there is some data in the obstetric literature for magnesium as a neuroprotective agent.
It is. You're absolutely right. So it's neuroprotective for the preterm fetus. And so when magnesium sulfate is given for the indication of preterm labor, it can be stopped immediately after delivery. So it's important to make that distinction with the obstetric staff, because if a patient is on magnesium sulfate for preeclampsia, they have to get it long after delivery. But if it's for preterm labor and it's neuroprotection, you can stop that. Right, or you absolutely should stop it right after delivery so the mother doesn't have any effects from that.
Right. Clearly, once the baby's out, there's no advantage to the baby to continue giving it to the mother.
Correct.
All right. Are there other medications in terms of tocolytics that we should talk about?
Just briefly, calcium channel blockers too, like nifedipine, can be used as a tocolytic.
Okay. What about...
Okay, let's... Yep. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Let's move on to anti-seizure drugs, because these drugs are sometimes given and they have implications for pregnant patients. So phenytoin is an anticonvulsant. It's a very effective anticonvulsant, but it's also a competitive inhibitor of vitamin K. And so we really, really want to avoid giving phenytoin during organogenesis in the first trimester. And you can get two things with this. You can get fetal anticonvulsant syndrome, which is orofacial, cardiovascular, and digital abnormalities, and this carries a 2 to 5% risk of major anomalies when you're using phenytoin. And you could also get, if you don't get the big bad fetal anticonvulsant syndrome, you can get a minor syndrome called fetal hydantoin syndrome, which has more minor abnormalities. And people who are taking phenytoin have a 10% chance of developing this.
Okay. So is it safe after the first trimester?
Well, I think that it's safer, but I don't believe that people would want to give phenytoin unless it was really, really decided upon as a multidisciplinary decision. One thing I've learned in the real world practice is that even if something is a really bad drug during pregnancy, it can be given sometimes if a multidisciplinary decision is made. But for board purposes, I would consider phenytoin to be a drug that you just don't give during pregnancy.
Okay, great. How about are there other anti-seizure medications that we need
carbamazepine,
to talk about?
Yeah, carbamazepine is one. It can treat all the seizure disorders except petit mal epilepsy. But you do get craniofacial defects, fingernail hypoplasia, and developmental delay. It's also associated with spina bifida. So you want to avoid carbamazepine during pregnancy too.
Okay.
Phenobarbital can be is used for partial generalized tonic clonic seizures, and you can also have bad side effects with this as well. And valproic acid is another one that you have a risk of 1-2% of spina bifida in infants, and you can get a fetal valproate syndrome with epicanthal folds, shallow orbits, and low set ears.
So none of these sound good. Are there
any? Sound good.
Yeah. Are there any anti-seizure medications that are safer during pregnancy?
You know, not to my knowledge.
So essentially, it's a risk-benefit analysis. Someone who's pregnant with a bad enough seizure disorder may have to be on these, and then you're just running the risk of the fetal abnormalities. But you have to kind of, as you said, get a multidisciplinary panel together and make a decision, obviously, along with the most important member of the team would be the mother herself, and deciding what is best for her health.
Yes. So real briefly, let's talk about mechanisms of placental transfer.
Great.
So, in general, there are drugs that cross the placenta and there are drugs that don't cross the placenta. So drugs that don't cross the placenta tend to be ionized, polarized, and not amenable to crossing membranes, like drugs like lycopyrrolate, heparin, succinylcholine, non-depolarizing muscle relaxants. These are drugs that do not cross the placenta. In contrast, drugs that do cross the placenta, anything that crosses the blood-brain barrier is going to cross the placenta too, like drugs like atropine, scopolamine, diazepam, midazolam, propofol, thiopental, halothane, isoflurane. These drugs are going to cross the placenta and have an effect on the fetus. Also, there's a relationship between the size of the drug and how easily it's going to cross the placenta. So a drug that's less than 1,000 Daltons is going to have increased transfer. A drug that's more than 1,000 Daltons is not. A drug that has a high proportion of unionized drug in maternal plasma is going to cross easier than a drug that has a higher proportion. And there are some drugs that have transporter proteins on the placenta that will help transport across. And if a drug doesn't have these proteins, it's not going to be as transferred as much. And along those lines, there's something called ion trapping. And so ion trapping is something that's tested quite frequently. What happens is that you have an unionized drug on the maternal side, and due to a concentration gradient, it will cross the placenta. And once it crosses the placenta tends to be more of an acidic environment. And so if you have a pKa that's close to 7.4, which is the physiologic state of plasma, that drug, when it crosses into the fetal circulation, is going to be protonated and thus ionized, and it's going to be so-called trapped in the fetus. And so this can happen very easily with lidocaine.
Okay. So you can actually get higher concentrations of lidocaine in the fetus because it'll become, quote-unquote, trapped there.
That's correct. And the other thing to think about is protein binding. So protein concentrations and affinity for drugs on both maternal and fetal sides of the placenta can influence transfer of the drugs. And it's only the free, unbound portion of the drug that's available for distribution across the placenta.
Okay. So are there any specific drugs? You mentioned lidocaine. Are there any other specific drugs that we use commonly that we should kind of think about or avoid due to placental transfer?
Well, I think any kind of drug that you're using that's an anesthetic, you have to think twice about what's going to happen when it crosses the placenta and what context you're giving it. Like, for instance, if we're doing appendectomy, I'm less concerned about placental transfer in the second trimester than I am about if we're going to be doing a C-section and I'm going to have to deliver a fetus in the next 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
So it's all a matter of context, I think.
Great. All right. And then what happens to drugs that get to the fetus?
The fetus can metabolize it, or the mother can metabolize it. Typically, the fetus doesn't do much metabolizing until later on because the fetus has what I would consider to be a dumb liver.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, I think that during the third trimester, the fetus is going to take on an increasing role of metabolizing those drugs, but the mother is still going to have a significant role in getting those drugs away from the fetus.
Okay. What?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Let's talk about the FDA pregnancy categories when we're talking about bad drugs.
Great.
So sometimes this will be tested. Category A means that there are adequate randomized controlled trials in humans that show no risk. And so there are actually not that many drugs there at category A because you need sound scientific evidence to show that they're category A.
Right.
Now category B is that animal studies show no risk, so no human studies, but good animal studies, or the animal studies show risk, but human studies do not. So if an animal study and a human study is in conflict, or you just have a positive animal study, it's going to be a category B drug.
Okay, so that's A and B, and those are relatively safe in pregnancy to use either one.
Correct. A lot of our drugs are category C drugs, where animal studies show some risk, or there's no data that exists. So I know, for example, I think Viagra, I don't know if that has any pregnancy data on it, just because there's no reason to test it in pregnant patients. But so a lot of your drugs are going to be category C drugs.
Okay. And category C drug you wouldn't use if you didn't have to, but if you had to use it, it's not there's no known human harmful data.
Correct. And then category D as in dog, is there's evidence of human risk, but benefits may outweigh the risks.
Now, what would fit under there? Give me an example.
I would say that category D drug might be, I certainly don't want to give you inaccurate information, but I would think that a drug like midazolam might be a category D drug.
Okay. Sounds good. And then is there a category beyond D?
Yes, category X.
And that is what?
This is absolutely contraindicated in pregnancy. There's no indication that that drug should be used in pregnancy. So I would consider isotretinoin, that Accutane for acne, that would be a category X drug.
Okay. And similarly, if we go back to category D, I would imagine, and I don't know this, but we could check, but I would imagine that the anti-seizure drugs would be category D, because you may have someone with a bad enough seizure disorder where they need to use one of these, but clearly there's known harm, so you'd have to make that risk-benefit analysis.
Yeah, that's correct.
And then another category X might be warfarin, for example, where you would never really want to use it in pregnancy, and there's other anticoagulants that you could use, so you'd never need to use warfarin.
That may be true. I can tell you that I have used warfarin on a pregnant patient with HIT who had a cardiac valve.
Okay.
And so that was in the third trimester after organogenesis had taken place, and that was a multidisciplinary decision. So
okay, so maybe that's more of a D than an X.
Yeah, but it certainly is an X during the first trimester of pregnancy.
Okay, interesting. All right. So, good. Those are the FDA categories. Hey, folks, it's Jed hopping in here. I did just look this up after I finished the interview with Mike, and we were correct that the anti-seizure medications like phenytoin are pregnancy category D. Warfarin is indeed a pregnancy category X, though, as you heard from Mike, there might be a time when you do decide to use it. But in general, X meaning you would hardly ever use it, or you certainly would never want to use it unless you had, as Mike said, a really multidisciplinary board along with the patient thinking about it and making a decision, including talking to your legal representatives as well. All right, let's get back to the interview. So, Mike, one thing we hear a lot about is amniotic fluid. Tell me about amniotic fluid and what we need to know about that.
So the amniotic fluid, it's composed of fetal urine, lung fluid, skin, transudate, and water that is filtered across the amniotic membranes. It can also contain electrolytes, proteins, and desquamated fetal cells. Sounds like something you'd want to be swimming in, huh?
Absolutely.
So a lot of times we'll do amniocentesis, and amniocentesis is sampling of amniotic fluid. And the utility of doing this is that you can measure lecithin, sphingomyelin, and these molecules are used to assess fetal lung maturity. And so depending on the ratios, you can be reassured that the fetal lung is mature. You can also identify bacteria with amniocentesis. You can obtain fetal cells for karyotype. And alpha fetoprotein levels correlate with neural tube defects. So if you have a high alpha fetoprotein level, that's suggestive of a neural tube defect. Now, so when you perform this procedure under ultrasound, the risk of spontaneous abortion is 0.25 to 1%. And the operator will usually use a 20 to 20 gauge needle to do this procedure.
So this is what used to be thought of, and there's obviously a lot that goes into this, but people would use this as a way to identify any potential birth defects, especially in older mothers, trisomies, for example, but they'd have to weigh that against that up to 1% risk of losing the baby, where there's a little bit of an interesting calculus that happens now because we now have the cell-free DNA maternal blood tests, which can identify trisomies. Have you seen a change in the number of women opting for amniocentesis since those tests have come out?
That's a great question. I couldn't really answer that. I'm not around when the amniocenteses take place, but I think you're correct that, you know, talking to my obstetric colleagues, I think there is such a push for these more non-invasive tests that we don't really do them as often.
Okay.
So extending from the amniotic fluid, there's a condition called oligohydramnios, which is low amniotic fluid volume. And this can result from uroplacental insufficiency or increased renal artery resistance. And one of the problems of oligohydramnios is that it may predispose to umbilical cord compression, which can lead to intermittent fetal hypoxemia. So if you don't have as much amniotic fluid as you need, the cord could get wrapped around the neck or compressed, or other bad things can happen to it. And if you are post-date, so if you are past 40 weeks, you need to be screened twice a week for oligohydramnios.
And so you can think of the amniotic fluid, Mike, tell me if this is right, as being kind of like the cushioning. And so if there's less cushioning, as you said, you can get more compression of the fetus, the cord, et cetera.
That's a great way of thinking about it.
And some at least of the amniotic fluid comes from fetal urination. Is that right?
Correct.
And so you might get oligohydramnios from, for example, if the fetus didn't have working kidneys.
That's correct.
Okay.
The opposite of oligohydramnios is polyhydramnios. And this is excess of fluid in the amniotic sac. It affects about 1% of pregnancies, and it can be caused by diabetes. And the pathophysiology is that hyperglycemia can lead to fetal polyuria, just like you talked about before. It's the urine that makes up the amniotic fluid. There are conditions that impair fetal swallowing, like if you have a tracheoesophageal fistula or something that's going to impair the swallowing of amniotic fluid, that could cause polyhydramnios, and you could have maternal renal or cardiac problems that contribute to polyhydramnios.
All right, so good. And then going back for a second to the oligohydramnios, we talked about sort of lack of kidneys or not well-functioning kidneys causing it. And I think of it also, but tell me if there are other specifics, it's just kind of a sign of something's not right. But are there other specific causes we should think about?
Now, for board purposes, I don't think that you need to go into that much more detail.
Okay.
than what we have.
Okay. Good.
So let's move on to antepartum fetal assessment and therapy.
Okay.
So ultrasonography, you've got transabdominal versus transvaginal. Each one is used in different settings, like initially in the first trimester, you're probably going to use a transvaginal ultrasound because it's going to be easier to to locate and visualize the developing embryo or fetus. And then later on, you're going to use transabdominal because the fetus is going to be way up in the chest in some, when it gets really towards the end of term. One of the problems of ultrasonography are your false positive and false negative findings. And there's three types of exams for ultrasonography. There's a basic exam, which looks at the number of fetuses, like if you've got twins or triplets, the viability, the position, the gestational age, looking just for gross malformations, looking at where the placenta is, whether it's over the os with the previa, looking for amniotic fluid volume and the presence of maternal masses that are independent of the fetus. In contrast, the targeted or comprehensive ultrasonography is you're looking at the fetal structures examined in detail to identify and characterize any fetal malformation. And occasionally, you'll have to have a limited ultrasound that answers a specific clinical question. Like, for instance, many women get an ultrasound, and the ultrasonographer is a little bit hesitant to rule out cardiac defects completely. So you have to come back to get another ultrasound to see if you can visualize the heart better. And sometimes it's just a matter of where the fetus lies in the uterus. Sometimes if you come back a different day, you're going to get a different lie, and the fetus is going to be able to reveal the cardiac system a little bit better.
Okay.
Getting closer to labor, there's fetal heart rate monitoring. And so animal studies and clinical observation have helped establish a rough correlation between fetal heart rate abnormalities and perinatal outcome. It's not perfect, but we use it to detect fetal bradycardia, which is an indication of fetal well-being that is not very good. You can have internal versus external monitoring. The internal is obviously more accurate, but it's more invasive. It's kind of like the difference between an arterial line and a non-invasive blood pressure cuff.
Okay.
And the fetal heart rate is superimposed upon the ear contractions on the monitoring strip, and that's what gets us to our decelerations.
Yep.
And so early decelerations, that's when the fetal heart rate starts to decrease in lockstep with the rise of the contraction. That's believed to result from reflex vagal activity due to mild hypoxemia, and these are not ominous. In contrast, late decelerations, which happen after the apex of the contraction, are considered to be non-reassuring and reflective of uroplacental insufficiency. And the third kind of decelerations are the so-called variable decelerations, and those can be due to cord compression. And so, like in the patient with oligohydramnios, you're very concerned about variable decelerations because that could be reflective of a compressed cord. Now, along the lines of fetal heart rate abnormalities, that you have to look at the overall picture, which is the fetal heart rate variability. And so what you want to see when you're looking at a strip that's taken over 5, 10, 20 minutes is you want to see that heart rate go up and down regularly in cycles, because that's a reflection of an intact neurological system and also represents fetal well-being. The last thing you want to see is railroad tracks where the strip is just completely flat over a long period of time. That is a very non-reassuring strip, and your fetus is probably in a little bit of trouble if you see that.
Now, if there's reduced variability for a temporary period of time, it could be that the fetus is asleep. Is that right? And so if you then see the fetus wake up and start moving and the heart rate start getting more variable, that's okay.
That's okay, yeah. But, a flat strip, I mean, a really, truly flat strip, even during sleep with a normal fetus, you're going to see just a little bit.
Okay.
But you're right. And the other thing that you bring up is these tests can be a little subjective, and so they're not perfect.
Right.
And even though we do this stuff with fetal heart rate monitoring, it really does convey a limited benefit. So prospective studies will show a decreased one-minute APGAR scores, below four, and decreased neonatal seizures with fetal heart rate monitoring. But the thinking is that the damage is probably already done prior to the onset of labor. So if you've got a woman who's got really bad fetal heart rate monitoring strips, it's probably likely that whatever damage she has to the fetus was done weeks, if not months ago.
Okay. So I want to back up a sec to the early variable and late D cells, because yes, there's one way I was taught to remember this that I think is just a useful kind of way to keep it straight is, if you think about how the baby comes out, the first part of the baby to come out is the head. And so early D cells can be just from some compression of the head. And then the next thing that comes out is the cord, and variable D cells are from, as you said, cord compression. And then the last thing that comes out is the placenta. So late D cells can be from placental malperfusion. And so that's one way to keep those three straight.
You know, that's a great mnemonic. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Absolutely. So then, you know, I remember when my wife was pregnant, she would go in for these non-stress tests. And I always was confused. Yes. Why do they call it a non-stress test?
Okay, so non-stress, thank you for bringing that up. A non-stress test is a test that you put the fetus on the monitor and you just watch it. And so you record the fetal heart rate for about 30, 40 minutes, and you look for baseline fetal heart rate. You look at, for the fetal heart rate variability. You look for the presence of accelerations. You want to see periodic or episodic decelerations as well. And you're looking at the changes of fetal heart rate patterns over time. And so this is a test that doesn't do anything to the fetus other than just watch.
And so it's non-stress because you're not stressing the fetus, you're just watching.
Correct. In contrast, the contraction stress test is that you want to induce contractions either physiologically or pharmacology, and you want to monitor the fetal response. And so how do you do this physiologically? Well, quite frankly, you have the patient rub her own nipples to stimulate release of oxytocin. And just like when she's going to breastfeed, stimulation of the nipples will allow a letdown of the milk. Stimulation of the nipples will also release the oxytocin, which can result in contractions. And if that the physiologic stimuli doesn't do it, then you can administer titrated oxytocin. And what you really want is you want a minimum of 3 contractions within 10 minutes to complete the test. A negative test is no decelerations with contractions, and a positive test is repetitive late or severe variable decelerations.
And when would you do that test, Mike?
This kind of test you would do if you're worried about fetal well-being. So if you put the fetus on the monitor and you see kind of a flat strip, you might want to do a contraction stress test if you're not getting the results from the non-stress test.
Okay. Now, I will say my experience was that when my wife went in for the non-stress test, if they didn't see the variability and the accelerations that they wanted to see, the first thing they would do is give her some sugar. So they'd give her some apple juice or a piece of chocolate or something like that and see if that would kind of wake the baby up. And if that didn't work, they had this buzzer that they would kind of put on her abdomen, and it would buzz. The sound waves would kind of buzz the baby and wake it up. And we never got past that point. That always worked. But I will tell you that the buzzer to me sounded exactly like the buzzer from the game Taboo. And so when we were ever in the last weeks, when my wife, if she didn't feel as many kicks as she sort of normally did, I actually would go and get the Taboo buzzer and put it on her abdomen and buzz. And that actually did the same thing. I'm not recommending that. That's not a medical recommendation, but that is what we did.
Okay. That's very interesting. I never had to go through that with my wife, but that's something that I would probably do as well.
off-label use of Taboo.
And then the last test is the biophysical profile, and this is a sonographic scoring system performed over a 30-40-minute period designed to assess fetal well-being. So you're looking at things like fetal breathing movements, gross body movements, fetal tone. You're looking at the qualitative amniotic fluid volume, and that's pretty much it.
All right, and that gives you a score out of 10, is that right, or 20?
Yeah, well, the other thing is the reactive non-stress test. And so if you're looking at the scores, it gives you a score out of 10, and it's normal is 2 points, abnormal is 0 points, and it's subjective if you want to give them 1 point. And so For the non-stress test reactive field heart rate, you want to see at least two accelerations in 20 minutes. For the field breathing movements, you want to see at least one episode of more than 30 or more than 20 in 30 minutes. I'm sorry, 30 to 20 breaths per minute in 30 minutes. For the fetal activity or gross body movements, you want to see at least three or two movements in the torso or limbs. For the field muscle tone, you want to see at least one episode of active bending and straightening of the limb or trunk. And for the qualitative part, you want to see at least one vertical pocket greater than 2 centimeters or more in the vertical axis. That's an ultrasound term that I don't do on a regular basis.
All right. So those are the five components of the biophysical profile worth 2 points each, up to 2 points each. So 10 would be a perfect score.
Correct.
Great. All right. Anything else that we didn't cover?
No, there's one more part, antiparam therapy, we can get through real quick.
Yeah, let's do it.
So antiparam therapy, you have antenatal corticosteroids. These are given to prevent respiratory distress syndrome in preterm infants. How it works is to increase pulmonary surfactant by inducing type 2 pneumocytes in the lung. It induces cellular differentiation at the expense of growth. The vascular GI endothelial cells are induced too. And the result is that we have less intraventricular hemorrhage and necrotizing enterocolitis with antenatal steroids. And the drugs that we typically give are either betamethasone or dexamethasone. So this is an important therapy for the preterm babies. A lot of times we'll try to hold off delivery for a day or two to get these steroids on board and let them work. And finally, an emerging field is fetal surgery.
Yeah.
And so it's possible to repair potentially life-threatening malformations that are understood by ultrasound prior to delivery. And not surprisingly, fetuses with normal karyotypes will do better than fetuses with abnormal karyotypes. The best time to operate is prior to viability. And so if you can catch this before 24 weeks, it's better to do field surgery before that. And ultimately, the patient has to understand the risks and benefits. And there's not a whole lot of great data on these field surgeries. And so it really has to be a multidisciplinary decision that the patient makes with her team.
Yeah, so it's quite fascinating surgery, but as you said, definite risks, most profoundly, of course, being loss of the pregnancy. And so if you're pre-viability, then you would, of course, just lose the baby. If you're post-viability, then you often will go ahead and deliver the baby and hope for the best.
That's correct.
All right. And steroids, again, that you mentioned, so huge, huge point for a woman in preterm labor should get betamethasone to improve the outcomes, both from a pulmonary, GI, and neuro standpoint with the baby. And I believe they try to get 48 hours of steroids often. In fact, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe that tocolytic therapy is not that effective in terms of stopping labor completely. But if it can slow it down long enough to get the steroids in over 48 hours, then that can make a big difference.
Absolutely.
All right. Mike, any last words?
No, I think we've covered it. Thank you for having me again.
Thanks for coming on. We'll do it again soon.
Great.
All right. That's it for today. Remember, you can go to the website, acrac.com. That's ACCRAC.com, where you can leave comments on this or any of the episodes. For this specific episode, let us know. Did we miss anything important when it comes to obstetric pharmacology and fetal assessment? What do you keep in mind? How do you use these medications? Everybody can learn from seeing your comments on the website. Also, you can join our mailing list in the upper right-hand corner of the website, where you'll get notifications every time there's a new episode, as well as anything else I might send around. If you are enjoying the show and you haven't already, please take a moment and consider going to iTunes and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you want to get in touch with me, you can, of course, leave a comment on the episodes. I see all of those and try to respond to all of them. And you can also email me at acrac@acrac.com. All right, that's it. Thanks for listening. For the ACRAC podcast and Dr. Mike Hoffkamp, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.